Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Radio Imbibe from Imbibe Magazine. I'm Paul Clark, the executive editor of Imbibe. It's late October, and between Halloween and Thanksgiving and heading into the winter holidays, festivities are going to be ramping up until the end of the year. But this year is 2020, so those festivities are going to look a lot different as we stay close to home and keep our gatherings small or maybe take them online. A lot of times when we share drink suggestions for celebrations or for just marking the end of the day, we're talking about things like martinis and Manhattans and holiday drinks and all kinds of traditional cocktails. But it hasn't been an easy year for anyone, and I think many of us have learned by now that we need to exercise some self-care, and taking care of ourselves extends to being aware of what we're putting in the glass at the end of the day. Maybe you've made the choice to step away from alcohol permanently or just for a little while, or maybe you just like to have an occasional alternative in your cocktail hour rotation that doesn't include alcohol. There should still be some options for you that provide some sense of satisfaction through the drink's flavor and character and all the trappings. So for this episode, we're taking you in that direction with a conversation with Julia Bainbridge. Julia is a longtime food writer and editor. She's got a new book out called Good Drinks, and it's about, well, drinks that not only have the shared characteristic of being good, but of all being alcohol-free as well. She gathered these recipes during a pre-COVID cross-country road trip, stopping in at some of the nation's best bars and restaurants and finding out the best options they offered for drinks composed without the use of alcohol. Here's our chat with Julia, and look for a link to her book in this episode's detailed notes. You know, the food and beverage world is at a point where alternatives to alcohol are increasingly desirable and necessary, and a book like yours is increasingly desirable and necessary. But as you know from your years in journalism, for a long time, writing about alcohol-free cocktails always kind of felt cringy in a way. I mean, it was almost apologetic. And when you talk to a lot of people, it seemed like the creative process kind of plateaued once you got to like fizzy lemonades or a Shirley Temple. But when you set out to write this book, how did you prepare yourself to move beyond that? And what made you realize that the drinks world was ready to move beyond that as well?
I didn't need to do much preparation on my end because the drinks world was moving beyond. On that. I mean, I really approached this as a journalist reflecting what I saw going on. And serendipitously, this happened at a time when I removed alcohol from my life, this being my seeing drinks on menus, okay, so taking up real estate on menus that were not Shirley Temples or, as you say, a fizzy lemonade. And, you know, being somebody who looks for food and drink trends, I would have noted this, but I also, because out of my personal interest in being out at bars and restaurants with friends and wanting to have something that wasn't soda and wasn't water, turned out there was never a better time to become a non-drinker. So, you know, what I had access to in New York at the time, I wanted to reflect. I also wanted to go out on the road and see whether or not it was happening in places beyond New York, which it absolutely was and is. And then I wanted to put that in this package, but it's very much, you know, a compendium that is sort of a reported work that is reflecting what was actually happening and continues to happen. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And, you know, when we go back to kind of that old world of the non-alcoholic drinks before they occupied so much real estate on drinks menus, a lot of the times, you know, they were basically just composed of the kinds of syrups and juices and sodas you'd already have behind a bar, just without the booze in there. So from, strictly speaking, from a no alcohol perspective, they fit the bill technically, but from a flavor perspective and from being satisfying, they still were kind of a mess. They weren't quite complete without the flavor characteristics and the palate characteristics that alcohol can bring to an equation. How did you find bartenders thinking imaginatively about ways to find the kinds of structure and balance and depth that you'd find in a standard cocktail, but without the use of alcohol?
Yeah, I guess like the best option we had before this era of reimagination was shrubs, right? That was like the most adult option, adult meaning it was something that challenged the palate beyond just sweetness, right? Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can answer a question. Like when you talk about the general, I think as you put it, flavor characteristics and palate characteristic of alcohol, what are those? Like what general flavor characteristics and palate characteristics does alcohol bring to the equation in your mind?
Well, a lot of times when you're thinking about a cocktail, when you're thinking about something that's going into the glass in front of you, you will have, you know, some kind of primary foundation of that, whether it's, you know, a botanical foundation like gin or something that has like vegetal characteristics like tequila or mezcal. And the alcohol alcohol functions as a flavor booster. It just kind of emphasizes those characteristics against which you can array the other flavors in the glass. Without the alcohol in the equation, looking again, you know, at those old form of just syrups and juices, then sometimes it felt like a three-legged stool with one of the legs missing, flavor-wise. Also, you know, just from a palate perspective, in terms of like mouthfeel and in terms of the kind of satisfaction that you have of taking a sip of something that hits your palate in a number of different directions, both in terms of, you know, the actual feel of it, the viscosity, the sensation in the mouth, as well as hitting those different flavor receptors, those different flavor characteristics, looking for that kind of complexity. So I'm looking for what are the kinds of things in these non-alcoholic drinks that are hitting similar mode or hitting those similar kind of satisfaction meters that drinkers are looking for.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that. Yeah. I think initially I was going to say, sometimes I think we do these drinks and ourselves a disservice by, you know, talking about them, by comparing them, right, to drinks with alcohol in them. You're never going to get the balance and depth that you find in a standard cocktail because alcohol is present there, right? So like, if you want to mimic the particular kind of complexity that comes from alcohol being present, you're setting yourself up for failure. These drinks don't have alcohol in them, you know, and you know, ethanol behaves in a specific way. And of course, as you say, it being a flavor booster to the botanicals that are already there, depending on what kind of spirit we're talking about, you know, that's also not there. But it is absolutely possible to make complex layer drinks without alcohol if you're knowledgeable about ingredients, you know, and or are willing to put in a little labor. And so that's where the people who are most successful at making these drinks are good cooks and just who know how to balance flavors. No matter what they're working with. And I think when you start to have deep knowledge of those botanicals, and maybe you're concocting your own tinctures or, you know, alcohol-free versions of those tinctures, finding other ways to like extract bitterness from roots, even from tea, oversteeping them to the point where, you know, those teas you wouldn't want to drink on their own, but then worked in with other components, it brings some of that depth you're talking about.
In your introduction, you note how during your long research road trip, you'd use the time to think about what drinks still held your imagination days later, what still kind of felt fresh in your mind and still exciting. What were some of those moments where you thought, you know, this drink is what I'm looking for? What were some of those drinks that really caught your attention and kept you excited about this?
Oh, how can I translate that kind of arbitration that goes on in one's mind into words? Let's see. You know, it has to be a level up from a fizzy lemonade. As we talked about before, it has to do the work of fighting against the bad reputation this category of drinks has of being too sweet. And if sweetness was the prominent taste, there had to be something going on in that recipe that made that acceptable. And I think it also had to surprise me or my audience. This isn't necessarily written for bartenders. So like lots of drinkers who aren't professionals, you know, still don't think to salt their cocktails at home or wouldn't imagine some of the flavor combinations in the drinks here or wouldn't ever think to put avocado in a drink that is in a smoothie. So under what category does that quite fit? I'm not sure, but that element of surprise. And then, of course, the boring work of making sure there's a range of flavors and levels of labor involved and other qualifications. It had to be listed on the menu. You know, part of the mission of this book is to make non-drinkers feel seen, is to make people who don't drink for whatever reason, and especially I had in mind people who don't drink at all, who maybe have, you know, historically felt like second-class citizens when they go out to bars and restaurants because they know to flip over the menu and look to the bottom, you know, this book very much exists to show them all of the delicious stuff there is out there actually to drink and to make it look like a party. And so some of my reasoning for including drinks doesn't necessarily have to do with the drinks themselves, although it of course includes that. But so, you know, it had to have been listed on the menu of the bar or restaurant from which it came. And this isn't exactly part of your question, but something that comes to mind and why I did the trip the way I did was I wanted this to act also as a guidebook, a literal guidebook, right? So a guidebook as to what to make at home. But of course, it's sad to talk about this now because we can't go out to these bars and restaurants. But I really wanted all of the locations from which these recipes came to have my stamp of approval as to, like, this is actually a cool place to go and hang out, and the staff is knowledgeable and the ambiance and all the rest of that.
Can you give me an example of one of the places and one of the drinks where you're like, hot damn, that's what we need?
Yes. Okay, so this is interesting because I'm going to bring up an example that didn't come from a bar at all. Actually, I was in Gabby Malarznik's living room, but she made a version of this drink, the ume, and everyone we know, or Yumi and everyone we know. She made a version of that for me in her Los Angeles kitchen. And yeah, I remember driving out of the city the next morning and my tongue was just like watering as it re-registered all of the things going on in that drink. There was the salinity of umeboshi vinegar, and it kind of intensified the watermelon juice she had pressed. There was also an herbal component in there. So the watermelon juice, it was actually a tomato and watermelon juice with a little basil blended into that. And I guess there's no more sophisticated way to put it than my tongue was watering as I thought of this drink. And it was something that I wanted to have again, something that I would drink the whole glass of, and something that I found so delicious that I would absolutely put in the effort to make it at home. I'll never be able to make it the way Gabby does because she's a pro, but I've done my best.
And when we look at this drink, I mean, it's fairly straightforward in some ways. As you mentioned, it has this tomato watermelon mm-hmm. juice, which is tomatoes and watermelon and fresh basil. It's got some fresh lemon juice in there, of course. You know, you need some acid just to boost things. You have simple syrup because you need some sweetness, as always. And then, as you mentioned, it has umeboshi vinegar, which is really the kind of thing that not everybody's going to have in their pantry, but it's the kind of thing that can be that secret sauce in a way. Add that to the drink. It's going to bring that complexity and bring a flavor that may not be familiar to you initially, but it's going to catch your attention and function well with the other ingredients in there.
You put it better than I could. Thanks for that.
Well, and I mean, this gets to one of the
points. I'm convinced I made a good selection now.
and that gets to one of the points in the book where, you know, ingredient-wise and process-wise, we're also looking beyond just keeping honey and grapefruit juice and ginger ale around. You know, you've got shiso tea in some recipes for juice. You've got kefir. You've got syrups with pandan and coconut. And you've got lots of mushrooms in here. There's a recipe with spiced mushroom salt in here. Were you concerned? mm-hmm. You know, were you concerned at any point about setting the complexity bar too high? And how did that factor into your decision making when you're selecting the recipes and explaining these for readers?
Yes, I was concerned. In fact, I do so much to accommodate the reader, almost kind of apologizing, I feel like, sometimes for the labor at times. So if I could do it over, I think I would ease up on that. I talked to Jim Meehan a lot about this. And he was like, you know, I'm more defiant about things like that. You know, why do we have this notion that cooking is something you're required to labor over to achieve results, and drinking should just be a flip of the cap, right? I think the reason why I went for some of those level 4 commitment recipes was, again, part of the mission of the book is to show people who don't drink for whatever reason all of the delicious stuff there is out there for you to drink, and all of the care and labor that is actually being put into this drink, which, again, historically, you kind of felt like you were getting the throwaway ingredients, or, you know, the juices and syrups, as you said, that are going into the real quote unquote cocktails, and they're just kind of throwing them together for you. So no, actually, these are quite like intentionally non-alcoholic. And some of them require some pretty painstaking labor. And I think it was important to represent that. Some of those recipes, I'm sure no one will make, but I wanted to include them just to, again, show you the range here and where these flavors can go. And that's part of the reason to include ingredients that come from like all over the flavor spectrum is just like, look at all the places these can go. Look how interesting this category of drink are. And while, I don't know, these may be fighting words for you, but I would argue that while, as you said, alcohol boosts certain flavors, I also think that alcohol being the ethanol, right, the thing that's present in any of those, you know, spirits or wine, does like take up some real estate flavor-wise. And I would argue when you remove that, you kind of have some more room to let the other ingredients shine. mean, I know it doesn't always work that way, but I do think like that's why we could go to some of the crazy places we did with the drinks in this book. Mushrooms is one great example, I think. Well, but let's see. Yeah, are you going to fight me on that? No.
I was going to say, go ahead. No, I'm all prepared on that one, but go ahead. Finish your thought.
And again, I guess I should, I probably shouldn't make claims like that because I do not call myself a drinks expert. I'm a great appreciator. And, you know, the work of this book, it's the work of other people that are featured in this book that I put together. I don't even often say that I wrote this book, right? Like I put it together. Going back to the complexity thing, I think I wanted to make it easier on people by giving each recipe a complexity rating. I know that I get frustrated when I'm flipping through a cookbook and something is sort of advertised to me in the head note as being quick and easy. But in fact, when I read the recipe, I realize that there are two sub recipes and it's a Tuesday and I don't even want to make my own vinaigrette. So I can be a very lazy home cook sometimes. So the idea was, you know, just give it a rating so that before you do the work of reading the full recipe, you can know what you're in for and decide to move on to a level 4 for a weekend project.
Yeah. And I think that's really handy because, you know, sometimes with readers, there's always that trust factor of putting something new in front of someone and saying, no, really give it a shot. It's pretty good. Even if it sounds kind of weird because you have mushroom salt in there, you need to give this a shot. It's worth the try. And as you said, I'm loving that you have this commitment level next to each recipe of indicating how much work relatively this is going to take and how much focus it's going to require. Because sometimes, yeah, you want something that you can just knock together on a Tuesday night. Other times, you know, we're all still stuck at home on one level or another over the weekends, and we're looking for things to keep ourselves occupied. And there are certainly some things in this book that would fit that bill.
What I've done is kind of like document the front row here, right? Or like, this is the first inning of this, right? And so this book is foundational, right? I think it like sets the stage for what's to come later. And the tenets of building these drinks and all the technical particulars, that's for a bartender to do. Our you know, the great Derek Brown is going to be putting out a non-alcoholic drinks book. And I think he really has his sort of theory of building these drinks. What I've done is to begin codifying something that's nascent and kind of like drawing a circle around what this looks like. And I think that work is kind of enough in what I'm capable of.
We were talking earlier about cocktails made with traditional alcohol, which ethanol has that component to it that boosts flavors and enhances flavors. Once you remove ethanol from the equation, you're still looking at balances of flavors and balances of characteristics that you want in the drink. Some ingredients, such as acids, things like shrubs or things like vinegars, have that kind of pronounced characteristic that can be very sharp, can be very pointed and, you know, kind of hold their own in the glass. But then you have these more nuanced ingredients that you're seeing used in some of these cases. Things like, you know, you have a drink with turmeric ginger honey syrup and the turmeric, which has that kind of earthy component that's going to be a little bit more subtle, but play against those other kinds of things. You had drinks in here with coffee syrup, you know, which again, coffee is a little bit more prominent flavor, but it has that kind of earthiness, that kind of good base note to it, as well as things like tomato water, you know, which is much more the lighter, more kind of ethereal flavor and offers that kind of brightness. So I guess the interesting thing I'm seeing in here and I'm looking for from you, what kinds of approaches did you see in terms of putting these flavors together that were actually weaving these complex ingredients together, complex flavors together with these greater nuances?
The very point you're making is why these are not fizzy lemonades, right? There is a more pronounced flavor. There's maybe a smoky lapsang souchong tea. There's maybe miso that brings in a savory component and balances out the apple juice there. You're getting at what makes these drinks not Shirley Temples. And, you know, the book exists to highlight all of those different flavors, all of those different approaches, but I'm not sure it fits under one kind of easy thesis. It's all across the flavor spectrum and technique spectrum, you know?
And I think one of the things that's interesting about the recipes in the book and the approaches that are being taken is they are requiring this level of complexity of flavor and an ingredients. And what that does in some ways is, to your point of occupying real estate on a drinks menu, it almost gives them gravitas, gives them a little bit more beyond just a simple ABC, where it's something that you can look at the description of the drink on the menu and the ingredients are going to be every bit as complex as the rest of the cocktails on the menu. The flavor components are going to be every bit as much complex. So in a way, you're not going to be having to flip over the menu and look down at the bottom for the non-alcoholic options, because these very much hold their own against a lot of those other recipes on the menu.
Yes, but some of them are so simple. You know, I think of Evan Zimmerman's drink, which is, you know, we keep referencing the Lapsang Souchong. It's cherry juice and Lapsang Souchong tea. That is it. But the surprise element to me, again, not being someone like you or bartenders who, you know, have been working with liquid, you know, every day for decades, like, oh, yeah, why wouldn't I think of putting this tea variety in a drink? Why have I never thought to mix it with something? I seem to just brew Lapsang Souchong tea and have it on its own. Why do I only think of mixing Lipton with other things, right? So I just think that was the surprise element there, but it's still a very simple drink, but sort of caught my, that's one that stuck with me as I drove around as well.
Right now, we're also seeing increasing numbers of alcohol-free spirits. We have to throw the air quotes in there. Spirits show up on the market, designed to function as cocktail ingredients. And in some cases, they're aiming to replicate a flavor or to mimic a spirit's flavor, while in other cases, they're going very much in their own direction in terms of the kinds of flavor characteristics that they bring. Seedlip may be the most prominent example, the most familiar to a lot of people, but there are many others that have recently joined it. As you surveyed this realm of alcohol-free cocktails and talk to bartenders, what kind of role can these ingredients play, and how should we think about them differently than we do standard alcohol-rich spirits?
Yeah, they're definitely not replacements for alcohol-rich spirits. I mean, I think I did see some people basically replacing gin with Seedlip Garden, and it's just not going to work that way for all of the reasons that you've pointed to, you know, to what alcohol does in a mixed drink. This doesn't have alcohol, so it's the biggest thing is in terms of mouthfeel. It's just not going to produce a non-alcoholic version of the exact same thing. I think that, like, you know, look, there's a lot of variety out there, and different products aim to serve different purposes and satisfy different wants. I think the role for the bartender is, as more and more of these come onto the market and are legitimately delicious, then you can just open and pour that in with one or two other components and not have to build these drinks from scratch and go out and get a branch of pine needles and steep those into a tea and all the rest of it. Now, you know, some people like that, including myself. You know, I surprised myself that as a relatively lazy, oftentimes home cook, I really enjoyed putting together these drinks, but that's not the case for everybody. So I think like some home cooks will really like to rely on these, you know, build out their non-alcoholic home bar and can open and pour something. But again, for bartenders too, to not have to put so much labor into making these drinks if they're wanting to make non-alcoholic drinks that are not the fizzy lemonade as we keep returning to, great. There are other people out there doing the work for you, and you can lean on their products. And yeah, I mean, so personally, you didn't ask this, but I'll offer that I'm a fan of anything that leans into bitterness. So Gia and Ganista are two of my favorite non-alcoholic beverage products. And I'm so glad Seedlip exists. I think talking to bartenders, it's a polarizing product. But I think that the reason that anyone might not like Seedlip is that they've kind of mismanaged their expectations of it, or they don't understand why it's worth what it costs. And I think we're going to kind of be in an education phase for a while. And yeah, the air quote spirits thing, you know, even I, as a champion of this category of drinks, I wonder, like, when it comes, should we be trying to make non-alcoholic spirits? Like, you know, should these products have real value? Because again, bartenders and home bartenders can lean on them to make more interesting non-alcoholic drinks, which is, again, what I'm all about. But should we be making non-alcoholic gins? You know, I mean, I think that's what I like about Seedlip, is that each product is its own thing, right? Like, given its own unique name, there's Garden 108 that tastes like peas, rosemary, thyme, spice 94, Grove 42, I think, is the other one. They're not, like in the case of Ritual, non-alcoholic whiskey, which of course is problematic for those people who, some people may be triggered by those products, and that's tricky. Some people definitely who have come to not drinking because of a substance use disorder won't want to buy my book, because even working with all the cocktail accoutrements is triggering for them, right? Yeah, I don't know. Should we call them spirits? They're not spirits. Like, the transformations that make them spirits are predicated on alcohol being produced. And I guess I understand why we use that term. It communicates to the consumer how this product is meant to be used, but it's worth thinking about kind of all the nomenclature around this category.
And you wrestle with that yourself, as you note in the introduction, when you were coming up with what to call this and what to call these things. Because I think, you know, we both just kind of feel the hair on our neck rise when the word mocktail is mentioned. And there are so many ways to address this category of drinks, and so many of them don't feel quite correct or quite apt, or just feel kind of silly when you say it. But as you said, you know, you just called it good drinks and just left it at that and put that out there.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would be totally unfair to do that in a bar. So let's just like get that. Like, I would never call them good drinks if this were a menu in a bar, because, you know, your customers deserve clarity. But I think, yeah, my approach has been to perhaps defiantly call them drinks. Like, think about when people make plans with each other to get a drink. Like, it's assumed that that drink means an alcoholic one and that you're meeting in a bar. And I guess my intent is to subvert that a bit. But I'm very aware that it's a sort of vague title, which is why the subtitle is Dr. Susie and Long. And actually tells you what you're getting here, which is non-alcoholic recipes. But yeah, the whole mocktail thing, I like cringe over it less than some people. I understand it's effective. Like, people know what it is. It's one word instead of some clunky, you know, non-alcoholic cocktail, alcohol-free mixed drink, whatever it is you're going for. I cringe over it less. I do though. See why people cringe over it. And I think it's great that we're trying to come up with something to replace it. It feels juvenile, right? Like, it sort of implies that the drink is a lesser version of the real thing, quote unquote, real thing. So yeah, we need to settle on something. We need to sort of collectively align on terminology that we really embrace.
Yeah, there's some questions that will never be answered because you're never going to satisfy everyone on it. But on having a compendium like this come together, especially now, you know, when we're 7 months into the COVID crisis, people are still locked down, and probably we're looking at a long autumn, a long winter ahead, and the holidays are coming up, and, you know, the old Zoom happy hours are feeling a little tired, and some people are feeling a little tired and may need a break from what they've been doing before. I think having these kinds of options available to them that still let you exercise the creative process and still excite your palate in some ways, but that just removes the alcohol from the equation, I think this could be really necessary and really useful to a lot of people at this time, as well as a hell of a lot of fun for people who are just looking for something, you know, cool to do.
Good. Yeah, I'm glad that's the point. And I hope so too. And this is definitely meant to be an inclusive book, you know, but the subtitle that you're not drinking for whatever reason, that could be just maybe you're doing a sober October, or maybe you're just not drinking this week, or maybe tonight, or maybe this round, you know. So it's really for everyone. It's also why I didn't include my own personal story. I didn't think it belonged here. This book is a celebration of all the delicious stuff there is to drink if you're not drinking. And it's not meant to be a sobriety book. It's not meant for only people who don't drink for life, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's for you too, Paul.
Well, Julia, thank you so much for taking the time to chat. I really do appreciate it. And it's a wonderful book. Congratulations on getting it out there in the world.
Thank you. And now that I have gone through the process of this, who knows, maybe I will be developing recipes on my own a little more, and you might see a book come out that I feel more comfortable with saying I authored. But I just, yeah, I want to thank all the people who contributed, thank all the people who are out there doing this work. I love the hospitality industry. I love bartenders. So much respect, and thanks for having me.
That book again is Good Drinks by Julia Bainbridge. Check our website and this episode's notes for more details. You can find us online at imbibemagazine.com and keep up with us on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and Twitter. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast to hear future episodes, and if you're not already a subscriber to the print and or digital issues of Imbibe, then we can help you with that. Just follow the link in the episode notes and become a subscriber today. This is Paul Clark from Imbibe Magazine. Thanks for joining us. I'll be back with you again soon. Take care.